Morning. If you have a cart that has two wheels, you want to make sure that the two wheels are working well together in order for the cart to move. We have a saying that when the two wheels of the Dharma are working well together, the cart moves very well and smoothly. So the two wheels of the Dharma are the spiritual wheel and the material wheel. And when the spiritual wheel is working well, the material wheel will follow and also work well. So on this basis, the Berkeley Zen Center has survived and done well for many, many years with the two wheels of the cart turning together in harmony. I think Master Dogen and everyone, all the monks, say that when the practice goes well, when the practice is sincere and people are practicing wholeheartedly, the practice place will survive and be supported. And it's always worked that way. Today, we are having our open house, and we're opening our house in a very transparent way. We don't want to hide things. We don't want to feel that there is some small group of people who are secretly making things up. And so in the spirit of transparency, we're opening the house and you can look into every detail.
Or skeletons in the closet.
Or no, we're looking. And if you find a skeleton, let us know. But you're not supposed to look in the closets. That's one of the rules. Somebody may not want you to look in their bedroom, but you can look in my bedroom. What we are presenting today is what all of the fundraising in the past, recent past, has produced, and what our projections in the future, for the future, need to be, so that you have a picture of where your hard-earned contributions have been used and will be used. I have this feeling, you know, I've always been a very frugal kind of person. And if I see a piece of wood, I think, well, where can I use this? You know, it doesn't matter how big or small it is. Where can I use this? That's kind of like always been my philosophy. When we were on Dwight Way, our first Zendo, where we were for 12 years, when I saw a piece of plywood on the street, I would pick it up and use it somewhere. I never thought of buying anything. Never occurred to me to buy anything. You know, at that time, we were paying $130 rent a month. And Ron was living downstairs with some people, and we were living upstairs, and we had the Zendo in the attic. And in those days, it didn't cost much to live. If you were around in those days, in the late 60s, early 70s, it didn't cost very much to live. And so we weren't basing everything on money. We were basing it on our labor. So there were always people around to do work who were willing to do this, whatever needed to be done, with a minimum of expense. And nowadays, everybody has to work really hard just to pay the rent. $1,200 a month or $1,500 a month for two rooms. I mean, anyway, so people have to work really hard just to pay the rent. Never mind all the rest of the expenses, right? So we use money now instead of labor as the fundamental engine that drives the repair cycle. So when you have four buildings like this, upgrading and repair and remodeling is always, something's always going on. So I remember this building was a house. When we moved in here in the 79, this building was a house with two apartments. So you see the divider. The divider was where the wall was. And on that side was one apartment, and this side was another apartment. And we needed a Zendo, and we decided this would be the Zendo. And we had an architect who, Ned Forrest, who volunteered his time to help us design this building as a Zendo. And so it took a while to do that, and somehow we raised money to do it. You know, this, the whole thing about moving into this place was that it was total chutzpah, naive chutzpah, because we didn't have anything. We didn't have any money at all. Pardon. I asked people to contribute $200, which was a lot of money then, as a kind of basis for, you know, we had about $16,000 or something, and prices were rising all the time in those days. And we managed to buy this property for $225,000, four buildings. And we used the community room as a, what's now the community room, as a Zendo. Bill Milligan and I, it used to be just a house. And it had a wall between the living room and, I guess, the bedroom. And Bill Milligan and I looked at each other and said, you know, this wall should really come down. Make a big space. So he went out to his truck and got a sledgehammer. And we looked at each other and we picked up the sledgehammer and we tore down the wall. And we thought that, and we put up a beam, you know, as a support, but we didn't really need to, because that building, 1929, on my right, has what's called a balloon structure. In other words, the studs, which are 2x4s, go all the way up to the ceiling, to the second floor. Usually, you build a house with one floor and then you build the next floor on top. But these, you'd never find any building done that way nowadays, because there are no 2x4s long enough. So, but that's the way that building was built, so we didn't really need to restructure it. But we didn't find that out till later. But that was a little room that we used, that space was our zendo at that time. And in order to build this zendo, we had to convert, of course, the building. And to convert to take living space out of the city, you had to compensate by putting it somewhere else, because you can't just take a building and make a business out of it. Easily, people do that, but so we had to. In order to do this, we had to find a space for living space substitute somewhere else. And so my idea was to always the building next door had about a 5.5-foot ceiling in the basement. So in order to compensate, we raised that building up. We had movers come in and raise the building up, and we created the downstairs apartments, two apartments, as compensation. That took quite a long time. It took about 6 months to do the zendo, and then about 2 years to finish those apartments downstairs. Because there's nothing here except a bare room, but with some lights. But for the building next door, there had to be kitchens and all that. So putting up the structure was not so hard. So it didn't take so long. It's the finishing of the details that takes so long when you're doing something like that. So somehow, we've never gone outside to solicit money or bid for projects. And we've always, our members have always been generous in supplying money, funds for when we needed to do something. So my idea was, I don't want to nickel and dime people for money all the time. But when we needed something, we asked for it. And people always come through because they see the need for it. We often see churches draining people's money, you know, always asking for something, and I didn't want to do that. So we've always maintained a kind of nice balance between sustaining our practice with dues and contributions, and when we really needed something, to ask the Sangha, and the Sangha always supplies. Because the place belongs to the Sangha. This is your place. You know, it's not my place. I do not own the Berkeley Zen Center. And I'm only here through your generosity as long as I behave myself. Which I don't always do, but you're very kind to me anyway. Because the place belongs to the members, the members have always supported it. It's your place. It's our place. And I can remember doing all this work in those during the 70s or during the 80s when we were creating the zendo and putting the apartments in the building next door. The Sangha did the whole thing, mostly the Sangha did up most of the work. Young ladies would wheelbarrows and up on the roof, and we did have carpenters at that time. My experience is that when you're doing a building project and you somehow carpenters come out of the woodwork. And so we did have members who were carpenters, and they were going to do the work for low wages. But the work kept going on, and by the time we finished, we were paying them regular wages. And I can't remember how we got the money.
Zendo cost twice as much as what we thought it was.
Zendo cost twice as much as we thought it was going to. Yeah. That's one of the problems. Yeah. But people did really good work. And Burkett and I went down and bought the cedar for this, the floor and the ceiling, and you know, the whole thing is made of, is the whole interior is cedar. It was like third grade cedar, and it was cheap. We always bought the cheapest stuff, you know. So we had it milled, and it was wonderful watching the boards come out. They had to be sliced in half and then milled, becoming groove. And then they're a little bit thinner than three quarters. So I've got to be very careful. It's soft wood, and but it's very beautiful. And we put the clearest wood in the middle of the floor, and under the tongs is where there are the most knots. And the ceiling, you know, making that the ceiling looks pretty simple, but actually making it come out right with those joints, like these joints here are pretty good, right? Like one board meets the other from the two sides. That was the most difficult part of putting this thing, the interior together, was making those boards match. Looks simple, but it's not. I can remember Alan Block and I working to make one board, just two boards meet all day long. So we had all this wonderful volunteer labor of our members, and we also paid some people, some carpenters, and but we got it all done. And it was that work brought the Sangha together. It really brought the Sangha together. One thing with getting this property brought the Sangha together, and then doing the work brought the Sangha together.
Did you buy the doors from Japan?
Oh, no, no. These doors? Yeah. These doors were made by
William.
A guy named William. His name will occur to me. But he was a really wonderful carpenter, and he loved doing this kind of work. But he was very slow. Not slow, but he was.
He waited until.
He was very hesitant.
Yeah. He wanted to get it perfect.
He wanted to get everything perfect. He was a perfectionist. And so he made the hinges, he made everything. This door and that, and those two doors, and he made that sliding bolt. Yeah, which works very well when you know how to do it. So he did everything. So we had in those days there was a group of carpenters who were really interested in Japanese joinery. And they were the kind of guys that would do this kind of work. Do you have any questions? Way in the back, yeah.
Can you tell about the pillars?
All these pillars, yeah. Thank you, Susan. These pillars we decided instead of having a cross beams going across the ceiling to have these pillars. And so Gary Snyder invited us to come up to his property and cut down the trees. So he helped us do that, and we have these pictures of us, you know, shaving the bark off. And a whole group of us went up there to do that, and we brought them back, and there they are.
Why are these beams canted?
Why are they
canted?
Oh, because they're warped. They weren't meant to be that way. There's a, you know, a little warpage there. Being frugal, I'm not sure about these beams, but in the other house, you know, we put in floor beams between the first and the second floor that were 14 inches high by 4 inches, 5 or 6 inches wide. And those were used lumber, you know, from piers, and there's a used lumber yard in Richmond. So I wanted to use as much used lumber as possible. And so that's where we got those beams. I'm not sure about these ones. But, you know, that's all well cured wood, you know. That, and it's much cheaper. So I always went for stuff like that.
I would kind of like to add that there's if someone wants to do work, I'm sure that there's always still an opportunity. And we haven't completely walked away from that. But I was just thinking while you were talking that, you know, about that we need to use money more now. And that's like us, you know, I sort of have to take supplements now that I'm getting older, and the buildings need some stuff. So it's kind of like the... You know, there's probably a lot more, well, there's even more gray hair in here now than there was 10 years ago when I started. So, you know, we've had to sort of grow in that way.
That's right. That's a good point, because my way is to not use money. But we have people who know how to use money. And so we've made a wonderful compromise. All the time we're kind of compromising and finding the balance between how to do something ourselves and how to use money. And I think it's working really quite well. So we're very, very, very careful. There was recently a earthquake retrofitting that needed to be done, and we got estimates of $50,000 and $30,000, and we ended up doing the work ourselves for almost nothing. So. You can spend a lot of money if you want to. No.
A couple questions. One is, could you talk about the altar a little bit, or where it came from?
This altar?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point. The altar, that we had an altar that was built by one of our members a long time ago, and it stood on a table. And someone, Daniel Leonard, who was a great scrounger, someone had given him this walnut, and I think it's a wonderful kind of walnut. It's a California walnut or something, and he just gave it to us, big sheets of walnut. And so I kept it for years, a long, long time, many, many years. And then one year I decided to, I thought it would be good to use it and build the altar. And so we went to Paul Disco's shop. You know Paul Disco? Paul Disco was is a builder. He built Larry Ellison's that big property of Larry Ellison's
palace,
Japanese-style palace in Atherton. And so Paul was a Zen Center student who Suzuki Roshi sent him to Japan to learn Japanese carpentry. And he came back, and he's been doing all these wonderful projects. And so we had him build this altar at his shop. And there was enough of this left over for the to build the altar in the Kaisando of Tassajara. Mm-hmm. Kaisando is the founder's hall at Tassajara. So if you go to the Tassajara founder's hall, you see the same wood there. So that's where that came from. Everything has a history.
I'm reminded of how experiences, you know, can stay with us such a long time. So you talked about picking up pieces of plywood, and I like that. And I hope you still pick things up. But I was just looking at this bowing mat, and I was pleased to see that it's sort of worn out. And it reminded me of experience at San Francisco Zen Center in the late 70s or early 80s. And it was announced that we got it, this beautiful new bowing mat for the Buddha Hall. And they told some amount of money that just made my hair stand on end. Maybe it was $5,000, or I don't know if I'm making this up or what, but I couldn't believe it. And around that same time, there was a purchase of a Tara statue. This just burned itself into my memory. I've never spoken of it, but now I am, because you talked about picking up plywood. So, and the statement about that Tara statue was, it's so beautiful, and it was a steal at $12,000. I really hated that. So, I mean, I just wanted to say that I appreciate your frugal approach to things. And when was the last time you picked something up on the street?
Well, depends on what you mean. Well, this bowing mat here was made at Green Gulch. Somehow, I'm not sure who it was, but said, I think the Berkeley Zen Center we'd like to make a bowing mat for the Berkeley Zen Center. So this is what they made. It looks like my grandmother's couch. But it served us well. It's wearing out, and we need it'd be nice to have another one. Somebody can make it. Peter?
I'd like to kind of celebrate how much we've learned being on the curve of gaining some sense of how, in this transition where we're using money a little more, how we've learned what it takes to work together carefully in the same spirit as when we ourselves were here hammering nails all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the project that gives the repairs and renovations on the house here where Alan and Laurie live upstairs was a situation where we got a really good fresh look at that, at the level of care and cooperation that it sort of came to us how that should be in a situation like that, where it's not as... I think when what happens in one way when you're using money, you really start to involve a lot of other people, right, not necessarily in the community, and those people get involved in your decisions. And so we learned a whole lot about how to approach a situation where we're working a little bit differently. And I just like to say that's something that I think is worth noting, that there was. That in the process of taking care of this place, we're also learning from each other and through the circumstances we place ourselves in.
Well, that's right. And also, designing. Like as an example, the back porch of the kitchen. The back porch of the kitchen is as you know, we decided that we were really going to do something with that space. And so then there's the question, well, let's see, who should be involved in dealing with that? So we decided that we would ask everybody what they thought, which is a wonderfully terrible idea. A terribly wonderful idea. But I think it's okay, you know, because you can't follow everybody's idea, but you get so many suggestions, and then you have to refine, and people have to accept what the refinement comes up with. So that's a good process, because there's so many Tenzos who use the kitchen, and so many people who, you know, what's going to be for storage, and what's going to be for passageway, and where do they put this, where do you put that. So it's a good process because it involves everybody and acknowledges everybody who wants to be acknowledged. And I think acknowledgement is really very important, because when people feel neglected or not seen or not heard, it's not so good. So there are two ways to run an organization. Well, there's more than two, but the two extremes are one person makes all the decisions, and the other extreme is everybody makes the decisions. Mm-hmm. Everybody making the decision means that decisions rarely get made, because it's always talk. But there's a kind of compromise. And it's, to err on the side of discussion, I think, is better, because I've been through both sides. And when I became abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, the abbot before made all the decisions, and then Zen Center turned out to do the opposite, where there was committees and committees and committees, and nothing ever got done. Everything got done very slowly, but it was better than one person making a decision. And then people would say, gee, you know, it would be so much easier if one person just made the decision. So anyway, it goes back and forth, you know, and that dynamic is important. Without the dynamic, you fall into a certain kind of pattern, which is gets set. I don't think that's so good.
I just want to sort of reinforce what Linda said about, I don't know, the modesty of this place is just wonderful. You know, and the way in which you pick up stuff from the street, we now call that recycling.
Yeah.
and the way everyone participated in it is, you know, I feel it all the time being here.
Yeah.
It's just very important. So I wonder if you can... I know at one time there was thought that there was a possibility that the building next door would open up, and we were, you know, it was, that was in the 90s, I guess. The
building next door opens up every once in a while.
Yeah.
And we get put our foot in it and get caught.
Yeah.
And it closes. A trap.
Well, it would be a very big and different...
it would be a whole different ball of wax.
Yeah. For a bigger monastery or living space or zendo or whatever would happen, but
here's my
the way it is now is wonderful, and I just I don't know if you can comment about a modest approach to enlightenment or spiritual place.
I can tell you about my feeling about that is that it's the Chinese restaurant thing. When there's this little Chinese or Thai restaurant, there's a little hole in the wall, and then there's a line around the block for people to get in. But they don't, the people who run the restaurant don't understand why that is. And so they say, as soon as they get a little money, they say, let's expand and modernize. So they expand and modernize, and the line disappears. Mm-hmm. It's only the mystique is is gone, right? So I want to keep our mystique of being of being small. It's great when it's really crowded. It's okay, you know. When you have the big plate, you feel, well, where is everybody? You know. So I like that. And we've been through the cycle, many cycles of next door, and it never worked. And that will never happen. And I doubt that will ever happen. And besides, the more you have, the more you have to take care of, and the more dedicated people have to be to doing that. And it's a great idea, idealistically, but practically, not so good. You know, my ideal, when I moved into Dwight Way, Hiroshi asked me to open the place, get a place. And so my ideal was to sit zazen, for a Zen student, to sit zazen, study, and garden. So I had this huge garden at Dwight Way, and that's where I spent my day, and then doing zazen, and study and work and so forth. For me, that created a great matrix for practice. And of course, not everybody can do that, right? That was fun for me, but everybody had their own work to do. And that still continues. When we moved in here, many years I rented garden space next door. That's why the gate is there and all that. And spent a lot of time fixing that garden and putting in the pathways and everything. And then she took it back. But that's okay. It's her property. We pay rent, though. But it was nice. I remember the kids, you know, grazing in the garden. You know, when the kids were very little, they would walk through the garden, pick strawberries, you know, and pick beans. And it's just like, it was wonderful. Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of my ideal. But that was the way I centered myself in practice. So, what's next? One of our spokespeople can tell me what's next.
What's next is we invite everyone outside for a celebration. We'll have a few brief remarks about to get everybody oriented about the tour of the building. There's food, there's going to be music. And so we will all convene again outside in a couple of minutes, and then we'll bring people together very briefly for a few remarks just so we orient everybody to what the possibilities are for the morning. And we will show everybody.
Okay. So you can wander around and wander through all the buildings, and you can come into my office if you want to, and I'll be there.
But yeah, so we're opening all the doors so everyone can get a chance to see behind the doors.
And if you have an opinion about the back porch, just stuff it.
A tour with guides?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, there'll be people.
It's not just
guiding
around.
Oh,
guide tour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. There will be people in every building and every apartment to ask questions and to let you know what's been done there. And
so are you on your own from one building to the other?
Yes.
So it's not guided like going around.
Peter.
I just read years and years ago how in China at one time, when monks were ordained, great numbers of them were ordained.
That's right.
They burned moksha on their heads.
Yes.
They became a little disoriented. come afterwards, and they were encouraged to just wander around. So all the doors of the entire place, the Abbot's quarters and everything, were opened up, and they were allowed to wander anywhere.
this is the model for this.
We don't have to burn mosques
up to do it. Okay.